If you were getting complaints, so many people are hanging on. Charlie, how are you? Okay. I mentioned you to a lady from Rehovot. She didn't get in touch with me. Careful. Don't tell me the chair is broken. I throw it outside in the hall and turn it upside down. They shouldn't bring it in, so I don't get hurt. Okay. Danny, wait, it's running away. Danny, I'm waiting for you. Yeah. I can run? Okay. Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2012, and I want to say hello to all of you who have braved the weather and sit before me, and hello to all those listening across the world. The schedule is as follows. I want to finish up Zionism today, contemporary Israel, and next Monday is the Shloshim for my mother. So instead of, I was invited to give a shiur. My mother was very active in Amit Women, but I don't want to cancel class, so what I'm going to do is next Monday I'm going to give, based upon the hesped I gave at the funeral, which was very brief, and I don't know how many people heard it, I want to redo the hesped and elaborate it so that next Monday's shiur will be a shloshim in memory of my mother, and I invited the Amit Women, those that are brave enough to find a place and to get here by 9 o'clock, are more than welcome. I expect to get an answer by Thursday how many are coming, because I arranged with Mark we might take out some of the desks and put in more chairs. And that's where you come in, Charlie, because this lady, Rogers, I think the name is, Rachel Rogers, so she was in contact with me. I know she knows you. I said to her, where are you from? She said, Rehovot. I said, no, Charlie Hexter. Ask him how to get to Gris. I told her, it's right off Begin, but you have to know how to get here. Now, last week we spoke about the centrality of Yerushalayim, the importance of Yerushalayim. How do you know you've arrived? That feeling of Yerushalayim, what Yerushalayim has done for us. Yerushalayim nodet chalkal shvatim. Yerushalayim is timeless. Skeinim v'skeinat, yeladim v'yeladat. And Hanidachim Beretz Mitzrayim of Din Beretz Ashur. You can look in, by the way, to the Malbim. He has a very interesting explanation. It's not like mine. I consider mine to be more correct for today's reality with Russia, with the Russian Jews. But he deals with the closer you were to Israel, Hanidachim Beretz Mitzrayim. So there you were closer, so that you actually had to be pushed away. But when you got far away from Israel, Avdim Be'eretz Ashur, there already you got lost. You didn't have to be pushed away. The assimilation happened automatically. But my parish is different, and I have a copyright on it. I once gave that Torah. I gave it originally in Woodmere, then I gave it afterwards in England. So the Rav told me afterwards, it's a Malbim. I said, what? We looked into the Malbim, and we saw Baruch Hashem. We both moved into a different mold. And all the tshuva that's come about because of Yerushalayim. And I just discovered something that I never believed. And it just proves my point. What do I mean I never believed? A student in America told me that he sees me at the Kotel on Friday night. So I said to him, what do you mean you see me at the Kotel on Friday night? So he said, there's a website and you can manipulate the camera yet. And he says he sees me Friday night. I don't know how we stumbled upon it, but I happen to now know, you can correct me, that there are two websites, and web, whatever they're called, web cameras, don't confuse me with the details, because it's beyond my span of knowledge. I didn't grow up with this Meiri, if you remember my Sunday class. And it's just, is that on 24/7? In other words, it works automatically, and someone in Chutz Laaretz, when it's not Shabbat there, can zero in.
It's run through
Aish. And I tell you, could you imagine that Jews have on that website all the time just to see what's going on at the Kotel? And it's very moving. I mean, it's very moving to me as a seasoned Kotel visitor to see the sights. And Friday night, I see, you can see the soldiers and the mob scene. And even yesterday in the ring, Just for the heck of it, at 9 o'clock, I moved on to that site to see what's doing, and you could see isolated people, more women than men, davening in the rain at the kotel. So, of course, that just proves my point. But let me go a step further. If this is the case, then, of course, Yeshiva University doesn't want to hear the words I'm about to express, for obvious reasons, and I imagine Chabad too will have difficulty with these words. But if this is the case, then of course the greatest mitzvah of our generation is Aliyah. And I don't think you have to be a great genius to understand that the miracle of the state of Israel, the Aliyah, the reawakening, 6 million plus Jews here. I mean, this is overwhelming. And where we were after World War II, and how many were wiped out, and the assimilation, and people who wouldn't give their own children a brit mila. Just think for a moment where we were after World War II. And now you see the state of Israel. And I want to devote today's Shayur to a realistic approach to Aliyah. And I think it's extremely important. Lalot atzaberina. And to me it means you have to understand what you're doing. Once you understand what you're doing, then it becomes a lot easier. And let me begin with Divrei Torah on a pasuk. I've preached this sermon many times over. I don't know if it's my own, if I heard it from someone. I've used it so many times already. Kaniti al yedei shinui. But lech lecha miyatzecha mimoladetcha mibeit avicha. And when you look at it, the order is wrong. Logic tells us, lech lecha miyatzecha, when you leave your house, you're not, for the sake of argument, I'm in Brooklyn. I'm now going to fly to Israel. So the first thing I leave is Beit Avicha, you leave your home. Then you leave miyatzecha mimoladetcha, you leave New York City, New York State, Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Staten Island, describe it as you wish. And then only at the end do you leave the continental United States. And yet the pasuk says, lech lecha miyatzecha mimoladetcha mibeit avicha, exactly the opposite of what we physically do. And there's a very powerful answer, and I think it's absolutely correct. You see, when we go in Aliyah, it's easiest to leave America. America, how much are we part of great America? Who say, can you see by the dawn's early light? All right, we have feeling America saved our lives, certainly in my case, my family saved our lives, no two ways about it. Went to war against Hitler, is going to face a big war with Islamic culture because Islam today wants to reconquer the world, and they're on their way to reconquering the world right now. If you watch what's happening in Europe, they face very little opposition. They are believers, and the average Christian in Europe is much less of a believer than the average Christian in the United States. So, we owe a lot to America. But yet, how much of Western culture, how much of the hippie culture? There are various cultures. America is a big place, Baruch Hashem. Well, that's relatively easy to leave. Then you come to where you grew up, the area where you grew up. There, of course, if you don't have happy feelings when you look back, you're going to need a head shrinker. But you know, we all had a childhood, and I look back very pleasantly, the Bronx, you all know what happened at the book launch here where we Tova Lichtenstein spoke about the Bronx, and everyone wanted a whole day Shabbaton. We would have arranged it, but we no longer have manpower, because we used to have an office devoted to alumni affairs. And Tova Lichtenstein wanted to hold, everyone wanted to hold a Shabbaton devoted to the Bronx. So many stories, you know, so many people, the Bronx, the childhood, Mount Eden Avenue, Rabbi David Hollander, Rabbi Yerucham Gurelik, the Rabbanim, and certainly the Yankee Stadium, let's not minimize the New York Yankees, Joe DiMaggio. You have a good feeling, and that, of course, is a little harder to leave. The hardest, of course, is Beis Avicha. There you had a culture, you had a lingo, you had a language, you had family, you had relatives, you had warmth, you had acceptance, and that becomes the hardest of all. And this is why the Torah is not giving the reverse order. It's talking about psychologically. Lech lecha meyatzecha mimoladetcha, and ultimately even mibeit avicha you have to go. And you have to understand that this is aliyah. It's not overnight. It's not simple. It's not that you just come and declare yourself an Israeli. You come depending on the age, obviously, with a lot of baggage. I would say the minute you go above the age of 9, 10 years old, you don't realize how astute a young kid is and how much of his world is already formed by the time he's in junior high school. And from that point on, Aliyah represents a challenge. There is difficulty. You're leaving what you're accustomed to. You're leaving what you know. I don't have to go any further than language. All of us, from the time we were little children, we master language, right or wrong. It's one of the great gifts of God that a two-year-old picks up in a year. He's a genius. Between hitting two and hitting three, this little kid is a genius. And here you're coming to a country where a two-and-a-half-year-old speaks the language of the land better than you do. Am I right or wrong, Yaakov? Just think for 1 minute. 2.5-year-old speaks the language of the land better than you do. And these are challenges. Now, I want to tell you, this challenge is nothing new. The truth of the matter is, when you go back to Bayit Sheni and you see Ezra and Nehemiah come in Aliyah and lead and want to lead the masses, and most of the people stay behind. They couldn't handle it. It was too challenging. Look at the Gemara in Kedushin, Daf Samach Tet Amid Bet. And the Gemara describes, and you're familiar with this, those of you that have learned Seder Zrayim and familiar with all the laws of Trumat and Maisra, this reflects in the Halacha today. Ezra tried to find Leviyim, and he couldn't find Leviyim. There were no Leviyim. And Rashi explains that the Leviyim didn't come in Aliyah. Why? And I'm quoting from Rashi. And it's very frightening to read this because nothing has changed in thousands of years. I'm quoting, U'minak she'erim lo matza lefi shayu yoshvim b'bavel b'shalva v'olim b'Yerushalayim hayu ba'oni u'b'toreach ha'malacha u'be'eimat kol svivotecha. And just think what Rashi is saying, that the good, fine Leviim, firm, pious, they were very happy. They had shalva. Shalva, when you have shalva in life, what do you want to call that? Peace of mind, contentment, little anxiety. It's like Lawrence. It's like Teaneck. It's like Borough Park. The average Jew there, it's like Beverly Hills. I know these communities. It's like Seattle. How many of you have been to Seattle? The Jews, you don't know what it's like in Seattle. The 630 Minyan. The minute the Minyan is finished, there's a minibus waiting outside to take them to, what's the high-tech base in Seattle? Help me out.
Microsoft.
Thank you, Charlie. Take them to Microsoft. They all have jobs. It's fabulous. And they have little frigidaires in their offices. They have kosher food. They're bishalva. You can understand it. And you come in Aliyah, and look what he says about Yerushalayim. Only they were poor. No, I don't have to tell you. Toreach Malacha. And those many are poor in Jerusalem because they don't want to work. I don't have to tell you what we're up against. Then those who want to work, Toreach Malacha, you have to work. It's a new work ethic. It's a different country. It's a different language. It's a different means of working. The whole configuration is different. And not only that, Ubeimat Kol Svivoteha. And constantly fearful of all our neighbors, of all our enemies. And I want to ask you, has anything changed? I mean, just think for a moment. Has anything changed? I can only tell you on personal experience. And I write this in Washington. When I came in Aliyah, Rav Avram Silber, Zeicher Tzadik Levracha, do you remember the name mean anything to you? God only calls him the best, what can I tell you? Avram Silber was Meir Kahanes Chafrit and Bnei Akiva. I write about him in Washington. He married Shoshana Talansky. Does the name Talansky mean anything to you? You can bless Moshe Talansky, the Olam Va'ed, he saved Jerusalem, period. And I sign on that. He saved Jerusalem. You don't know what we had, where we were up against. You don't know who Omer is. Shem Rishon Yirkav. You have no idea who these people are and what they're capable of doing. All right, I hope there's justice here. We'll see what happens. But Moshe Talansky saved us. Shoshana's his sister. Shoshana married Avram Silber. Bnei Akiva makes Meir Kahanes Chavrita in Meir Yeshiva. I write about in Washington what Meir said when he eulogized Avraham. He died in 1980, a young man. My father died the same time. We're both in the hospital together. My father at least hit 70. Avram Silber at the most was in his mid-40s, if I recall correctly. A blood illness, lo aleinu. Avram Silber came in Aliyah. He built the Yeshiva High School in Beersheba. The man started the transformation of Beersheba from a community of rampant assimilation of the Sephardic children, brought back Torah to Beersheba. Today Beersheba is an Ir Ve'Im B'Yisrael, but Avram was the first one. And Avram took me aside when I came in Aliyah, and he told me, you have to be like an Israeli here. Education has to be in the Israeli style. It's different than America. And I found that. I was already teaching. BMT had just begun. In other words, I don't know if I was the right person, but I certainly was in the right place at the right time. BMT had just begun, and I'll tell you a story. If I told you the story, stop me. I don't want to waste time. But this story says it all. An absolute true story. The early years of BMT, we had two, you know, you came, you were older, you were junior in college or post-college, so two young men came into BMT who had grown up in Crown Heights. And they're going to High Etzion for Shabbos. The yeshiva was new, just beginning, Rav Aaron had just come in Aliyah, and these kids were so excited because they knew that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein grew up in Crown Heights. And they told me afterwards what happened that Shabbat. They couldn't believe it. Rav Aaron was makar of them. They spoke about the teachers they had in common and told stories out of Crown Heights, and you know, Rabbi Kanatovsky, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, and the young Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rabbi Baumel. This was Crown Heights, Ir Ve'Im B'Yisrael. And after Shabbos, the two boys, two young men, go over to Rav Aaron to wish him Shavuot Tov. An Israeli Talmud comes over to them afterwards and says, Miatem, Miatem, Vihishalachem, Lelechet L'daber Marash Yeshiva. This is like, I saw this in communist Russia. Who are you? How dare you speak with the Rosh Yeshiva? Who gave you permission? Teach you a new word in modern Hebrew. Matan knows it from the army already. Distance. Yaakov, you've heard that word? Do you know the English word distance? Distance. Don't get too impressed with the word. Merchak. No one uses merchak. If Matan would use the word merchak, they'd put him into jail for 7 days. Desecration of airspace. Distance. The mafaked. Hamafaked shomer al distance. Have you done army? You know what I'm talking about? You don't approach a mafaked. You have to ask. Adoni mafaked, efshar lesocheich itcha. Understand humbly. And this was chinuch. Who ever heard of a Rebbe playing basketball with his Talmidim? And boy, I looked around at the Israeli chinuch and I looked around at some of the products and I said, wow. This Rashi says it all. At Toreach HaMelacha. I never went along with it. We brought about a revolution here, and I'll talk about it later. But you got to know what you're up against. You have to understand. Nothing has changed. This Rashi is if the words were written 2 seconds ago. Now, so why come an Aliyah? Why accept this challenge? Why climb the hill? Why leave Baltimore and your whole career here? You know, with Jaffe, the famous story of Cleveland, Professor Jaffe, he's won many awards. So why are you a graduate older than I am? And when he went in Aliyah, they were crying. His family had a big business in Cleveland, and he's going in Aliyah, and this was right either before the Six-Day War or after the Six-Day War. It's so dangerous. And he came in Aliyah, of course, and it's many decades later. Nebuch, the brother who took over the family business, was killed in the store in Cleveland in a holdup. And the brother who came in Aliyah, Baruch Hashem, is in his 80s today. So, you know, why go? Why face all this? Why accept the challenge? And here I want to tell you a story, and I want to give you a name, and you can put it all together. Then I want to give you my source on the story. When I was in Bnei Akiva, and you know, Bnei Akiva in my time was very powerful. It was an experience following the Holocaust. The State of Israel declared. And here in Bnei Akiva, and this young lady named Malka Grund, who later would become my wife, had a madricha who was my age, Miriam Beinhorn. Miriam came from a family that ran away from Hungary, got to the United States in the 30s, I believe. And the typical American story, she had a sister who was an actress, the singer. Her sister died of an overdose, I believe. Very sad story. Her father was a cousin in the East Bronx, struggling with Americanization. And Miriam, I can still see her father with a chazonish beard, not a full beard, but not a yekka beard either, Unungadish bond. And Miriam once said to us in Bnei Akiva, of course, we were friendly. She was not my madricha, it was my wife's madricha, my wife-to-be. But Miriam said to me, she says, Aaron, she says, I want to do something with my life. I don't just want to waste it and be another number. And I'll put it into context. What Miriam said was genius. I can tell you that Miriam Beinhorn, they will tell stories about her as long as the Jewish people walk the face of the earth. She came in Aliyah at a very young age, went to nursing school at Shaarei Tzedek, met a young Rav, a Musmach of Merkaz HaRav. His name, HaRav Moshe Levinger. Recognize the name? Miriam and Moshe, Pesach of 1968, decided to spend it in a hotel in Hebron, went in with a group of other Jews, paid good money, refused to leave Hebron. The army didn't know what to do with them. They took them into the local police station, army station. They slept on the floor. They pestered and bothered the government. Finally, they acquiesced and start building Hebron, Kiryat Abba, start building Yehuda, Sebastia, the Shomron. Every Jew who lives in Yehuda the Shomron today, and the fact that the state can survive, that we have borders that are defensible, all goes back to Miriam Beinhorn Levinger and Reb Yaakov Levinger. And that's the famous Levinger family, his brothers Yisrael Meir, who winds up in Switzerland, the rabbi, the expert on autonomy, you all use his books and study in Chulin, Bechorot, etc. And that's what Miriam said to me so many years ago. And you know something? Miriam was absolutely right. Look into Ezra, Perek Bet, beginning with Pasuk Aleph. You have an entire chapter, endless names. V'elu b'neicham b'dina holim mishvich ha'golah sheheglah nevuchat netzem malach bavel lebavel v'yeshuva Yerushalayim v'yehuda ish le'ido ha'sheba'u im zrubavel Yeshua, Nechemya, Sraya, Ra'alya, Mordechai, Bilshon, Mizpah, Bigvai, Yuchim, Bana. And it goes on and on, tens and tens and tens of names. Michael, give me the name of one Jew who remained behind in Bavel. Give me the name of one Levi who remained behind in Bavel. They're in the dustbin of history. The Jews who came in Aliyah, every name, every family, they built Bayit Sheni. And that's the choice a human being has. To quote Miriam, to be another social security number, or to move the mountains of Jewish survival. I never forgot what Miriam said, and believe me, she fulfilled it, and we try to follow in her footsteps. So this is the challenge. It takes a realistic attitude. You can't come in Aliyah thinking it's easy, it's 1-2, it's natural. It's difficult. There are challenges. Obviously, as the state grows, it gets easier. Today you have endless Anglos here. When I came, how many Anglos were there? There were how many YU people were there? You could count on the fingers of one hand how many YU people there were in Chinuch before 1969. Obviously, the more, the better. The changes, the innovations. But the reality has to be stressed. And I want to quote an article, and I quote this article purposely. I have never been able to locate the person who wrote this article. I am curious as to what happened. This article is 30, 31 years old. It appeared in the Jerusalem Post. It appeared March 27th, 1981. It's practically 31 years ago. An Exile in America by J. David Shulman. Anyone know that person? I mean, I would imagine today he's well into his 50s, if not older. J. David Shulman. Very beautiful article. And he writes, "Dear friends, I returned to New York to visit my parents and have not yet come back to Israel because I was going mad." Mad? More precisely, I felt like a potato being slowly grated, as though I was sacrificing myself for the ideal of living in the land. It was the vitality of Israel which for this round defeated me. It is the stuffiness of New York Jewish life which cradles me. By the time I left Israel, I had lived in 6 different apartments, gone to court to fight with a landlady, learned to shout and shove, being shouted at and shoved, and all in Hebrew. And, you know, this paragraph, there's a lot of truth to it. Again, if you live in Katamon, or if you live in Rehavia, Talbia, it's a gilded neighborhood. You're protected to a certain degree. I always say about the Shtiblach in Katamon, the only languages you hear there are English or French. You understand? And believe me, there are thousands davening there every day. It's mamish. Unbelievable how many people. And this Shtiblach I saw who built it was built by a YU graduate, Rabbi Arnold Rund, R-U-N-D. When I came in Aliyah, there was nothing there. There were no Anglos in the neighborhood. And many years ago, the Bentheims built a beautiful home. And around the corner with the Shtiblach, and Rund came in, and Americans saw, gee, the Bentheims, the Zussmans live here, it's the Bentheim family. We can live here. There's Shtiblach, there's a mikveh. And wow, what turned out of the Shtiblach? And today it's an attraction. People advertise, apartment for sale, easy walk within the Katamon Shtiblach. And of course, I don't have to tell you, I still get upset. You ever see Israelis drive? It's beyond words. I mean, the most basic lesson that I was taught when I was taught how to drive in Pennsylvania in 1961 is that you always give the right of way. You always are generous. And this was a guy teaching me that. If I tell you how to drive and you let a person into traffic, you're doing the Gemilut Chesed. Just think for a minute what it's worth You wave the person in, and he turns around and smiles at you. Can you put a price on that smile? And then when you're stuck, two lanes becoming one, what do Americans know? One, one. You go, you let go. You let go, you go. One, one. Here, you let a guy go in front of you, immediate later, another dumb Israeli thinks he's driving a commando car, and he squeezes in right in front of you, and boy, but I gotta tell you, it's getting better. It's getting better. Again, it must be the Americans, maybe the French, I don't know. But I know when I have to make a turn left against traffic to get into the street that leads to Rav Berlin, two out of three times a car will stop and wave me on. And I don't know. People say, well, they know who you are. They know who I am. I don't believe that. That every third driver knows Rav Rakefet. I don't believe it. But that's a beautiful paragraph. But then he says, and here he hits home, and he's talking about the good things of Israel. Once as I walked down an industrial street in Jerusalem, a Sephardic Jew in a suit and hat darted out of a door and grabbed me for a minyan. Another time in Bnei Brak, I saw Lubavitcher Chassid with compassionate, deep and humorous eyes sling a rifle over his shoulder and go off to civil guard duty. In those days, I prayed in the Meir Shalom Shtibel, a small shul near the open market. No one stared at my knit kippah with an indignant, uncomprehending scowl as if I was some Jewish bug. Not even in Meir Shalom. When I moved into an apartment in Bnei Brak, my downstairs neighbor invited me for a Shabbos meal, although I wore no suit. Later I learned that her husband studied Kabbalah. On a Rav Shabbos at the Western Wall, dozens of young men in shirt sleeves sang and danced. You could see they were proud to be Jews, to study Torah, to be soldiers if need be, to help in a country that is their own. And you see, that's the balance. And I have to tell you, it's very true. I've davened in many shtiblach. I've caught minyanim in Zichron Moshe. I've caught minyanim in Meir Shalom. No one ever made a negative comment because I'm not wearing a black hat, because I'm wearing a kippah srukah. In some shuls in Borough Park, you'll find you can't get an aliyah unless you have a black hat or unless you have a gotten. I don't have to tell you this famous story of Ben Brafman. You know what I'm talking about, right? I mentioned the name Ben Brafman. The two leading criminal lawyers on the West Coast and the East Coast are both from Jews. I happen to know both of them. On the West Coast, it's Don Etra, of course, nephew of Max Etra, who signed all our degrees when we went to Yeshiva College. He was chairman of the Board of Trustees. And on the East Coast, it's Ben Brafman. And Ben Brafman tells the story. By the way, I think he has a brother who's one of the Ramim in Mir here. He supports his brother, and I think half his kids became Haredim. And Ben Brafman is this top criminal lawyer. I understand we're dealing here a man who makes millions and millions a year. Any big shot who gets arrested, you have to go to Ben Brafman, and you know, with law, you know the judges, you know the DA, you know how to strike a deal. So Ben Brafman, when the Shpinker Rebbe was arrested and they broke that hold, it's 102 people were indicted, many went to jail, the Shpinker Rebbe went to jail. So Agudat Yisrael held a convention, I don't know if that's the right word, a public meeting against cheating on the government. The meeting was held about a block and a half from where I was staying in Borough Park. So Ben Brafman spoke that night, it was a packed house. And Ben Brafman, this famous lawyer, said, you know, it's about time you stop criticizing other Jews and this holier than thou when you got down to basics and you shaped up. And he says, let me tell you a story. And this is all in Yiddish he's speaking. And Ben Brafman tells the following story. One time he was in Wall Street, in that area, there was, you know, all the big courts are there, and he had a case, and it was late, and he had a chap mincha. So he knew a block or two from the courthouse, they have a minchah at a certain time. They're minyanim all over the place there. So he had yahrzeit that day. He goes into the minyan and he asks the gabbai if he can daven for a moment at the hot yahrzeit. So the Gabbai looks at him, no gato, no black hat, you can't daven. So he was so burned up that at the end of davening, he gave the Gabbai his card and said, one day you're going to be arrested and you're going to need me. Here's my card. Believe it or not, a few years later, the Gabbai is involved in some fancy devious scheme. He's arrested and he has to contact Ben Blachman, the man he wouldn't let daven for the Amid. So, and this is so true here, that there is a feeling of joint destiny. And you see it now with all our problems. You see Pappenheim, the official spokesman for the Eda Haredit, he speaks differently than any Eda Haredit person ever spoke before. Pappenheim, the great nephew of Anna O, Freud's famous patient, you know what I'm talking about? Who studied psychology here? Freud, what was the name? He used a pseudonym for the patient, Anna O. Anna O was Pappenheim, and this was his great, great, great aunt. And you see the way he speaks? Baruch Hashem, you can identify with him. The guy is walking with his feet on the ground. It's not like Reb Zalman, the Satmar Rebbe in Williamsburg, and the vulgarities he's expressed these last few weeks. And now I am in Brooklyn. I am eating again, and my cheeks are no longer hollow. I do not have to deliberate whether I can afford cottage cheese. And I'm serious. I can get a phone installed within a week, not 8 years. No, and you don't know that. When we came in Aliyah, I lived without a phone for many years. For the first year or two, I didn't want a phone. My wife didn't want a phone. She hates the phone until today, because the phone was her enemy in the rabbinate, her nemesis in the rabbinate. The phone rings incessantly. It's not pleasant. And it takes you away from your family. You're in the middle of doing things, talking with children, teaching children, and the phone. Then we ordered a phone. Oh, you ordered a phone. You know the story that made the rounds, that this Meir Sharim Jew, this Natura Katanik, got a phone and he made a kiddush. So they said to him, Yankel, you're such a shakis. You get a phone from the Zionist state, from the Zionistus de Medina, and you make a kiddush? He says, don't worry, I ordered in the mandate period. That was the joke that made the rounds, and that's what he's referring to. Today, of course, in Israel, see, a lot has changed. Cottage cheese, there was a big rebellion led by a yeshiva boy from Bnei Brak. Many of the prices have gone down, and there's continued pressure on the big conglomerates here. And thank God, with a telephone, you can get two telephones within at least 48 hours today. It's a different world on that level. No one is screaming and shouting. No one is shouting, Rega. The bus driver's not trying to close the back door on a pregnant woman. And my father, when we came in Aliyah, my father thought that Rega is a Geronimo call. In other words, when you get off the bus, you have to yell Rega like a parachutist is yelling Geronimo. And it's a very, very beautiful article. And he writes that he can't go back to America. He can't return there, he says. And there's so much falseness in America. I have visited some of the Torah centers of American Jewry, meaning Williamsburg, Borough Park, Crown Heights, small enclaves of Jews in Hasidic dress, surrounded and swallowed up by and mixed together with non-Jews. In December, only the most intense recluse can avoid the bombardment of Christmas. There was the Shabbos with friends in Borough Park when we didn't dare leave the house to go to shul. It happened to be Halloween. On a Shabbat in Spring Valley, we walked over to Muncie. The sense of wealth was overpowering, like the scent of a decaying woman's perfumed handkerchief. Oh, that's Mr. Blank, said my host's wife. He's so nice, you would never guess he is a millionaire. And you can all understand that criticism, which takes me into my next point. I want to warn you. I call this the combatant returnee. Meaning, when you've made it in Israel, you're here 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. I always used to say, it's best not to return to America. for a Shemitah for 7 years. Give yourself a chance to become part of Israel. And then you'll notice you'll have memories of America that nothing goes wrong. You go back to visit and you'll find that the New York subway system is not any better than the Jerusalem bus system. You'll find Los Angeles areas you'll be afraid to walk in the middle of the day. You'll find incompetence in the banks, just as you will occasionally find here. And you'll see, what do you have all these complaints about? It's psychologically very, very helpful when you go back 7, 10 years later and look around with more informed eyes. But there's a second side to this coin. People who come in Aliyah and integrate here. And today, most of our Anglos do integrate. It's not like 69 when I came in Aliyah on a boat. There was a boat in May, a boat in June, which we were on, and a boat in July. There may have been June, July, August. I think there were 3 boats. There may have been 4 boats, each filled with hundreds and hundreds of Anglo Olim. 60% went back ultimately. 70% went back. Today, Nefesh Ben Nefesh claims their rate of success is something like 98%. But when you go back, you're visiting, and you've made it in Israel, you're very upset with from Jews there. How can you remain? You want to yell, you want to shout, and I've seen this time after time. And I remember the first time I went back, 1977, I had already done basic training in the Israeli army. The government sent me back to address the Rabbinical Council of America convention. I spoke elsewhere in the United States in 77. And in Queens, the rabbinate made a little dinner in my honor. And I don't want to mention names. These were the finest rabbis of Queens. Not all of them are alive anymore. Not all of them are functioning. And we benched. And when we finished benching, I got up and said, I want to thank you for praying for my hometown. And here were Rabbanim, Gedolei Yisrael, Talmidei Chachamim. They looked around. What the heck is Rakefet talking about? I want to thank you for praying about my hometown. And I said to them, Uvenei Yerushalayim Yakodesh Ben Heder B'Yameinu. And you get upset. You're talking about Yerushalayim. And how can you remain in Queens? And how can you remain in Borough Park? And how can you remain in Lawrence? And why don't you pick up and come in Aliyah and cast your lot in with the totality of Jewish experience and Jewish survival and the Jewish nation and the Jewish people? And you get upset, you want to yell, you want to shout. And I always caution someone going back for the first time, the second time, calm down. You're not going to accomplish anything by yelling, by shouting, by giving them musa. After divrei chachamim benachat nishmayim. And you have to understand, lech lecha miyatzecha mimoladetcha mibeit avicha, it's very hard to pick up and leave. Very hard to give up what you're used to. Very hard to give up the environment, the shul, the mikveh, the kiddush club, etc. It's difficult. And many an article has been written. And let me show you some of this conflict. And you'll see pro and con and understand very easily what I'm talking about. This is an article that appeared in the Post, July 24th, 1990. It's by Nettie Capel Gross. Nettie Gross missed being my student by the toss of a coin. In the early 70s, so many kids wanted to study in Israel following the Yom Kippur War that Machon Gold was not big enough to house all of them. So they divided them into 3 groups. One would be in Machon Gold, one in Beit Vagan, and one in Netanya. And there was a toss of coins, and that determined where each girl would go. So I taught many of Nettie's classmates. And this article in the Post You can see Neri's anger at those who didn't come an Aliyah. New Yorkers are sympathetic to those who leave for personal, not global reasons. A breakdown, a midlife crisis, a divorce, a great job in San Francisco, but the need to subject oneself open-eyed to a drastic uprooting. The underpinnings of which are ideological indicates a person openly admires, but probably thinks he is a nudnik. At best, a nudnik with a higher calling. And she explains, moving in tandem with the times, it's logical then that while heroic things have happened on the Orthodox Jewish front, its baby boomers have essentially circled like wagons with regard to Aliyah. Like everyone else, they are clinging quite naturally to what they have, their myriad current accomplishments, the centerpiece when being quite possibly their unabashed, even masterful creation of Babylon on the Hudson. With the same diligence that may have driven the structuring of the perfect deal, the perfect kitchen, bar mitzvah and matzah ball, the observant crowd has committed their energies to creating the perfect Jewish community. The plethora of daily Talmud classes, kosher restaurants, yeshiva, charity dinners, shaitel salons, sharpness testing equipment, suggest that Aliyah may be in fact an idea whose time has come and gone. Romantic and well-meaning, but a pointless, if not absurd pursuit for someone who might otherwise have the good fortune to be young and alive in 1990 in, say, Englewood, New Jersey. And the article goes on and on, but you see what she is saying, that Baruch Hashem in the Gullis, she's very bitter, she's very cynical, she's very sarcastic. She is coming Aliyah, and her siblings, her relatives, her friends. Why Aliyah? Look what we have in Englewood, look what we have in Teaneck, look what we have in Lawrence. Look at the perfect society we are building. Why shake the boat? Why ruin the beautiful Atzecha, Moladetcha, and Beit Avicha in which we are living? So you can't yell, you can't shout. This article is an overkill. It's too sarcastic. You're not going to influence anyone. But you have to understand the mentality. I have another article that is unbelievable because this issue is with us until today. Jonathan Pollard, and the man has rotted away 26 years in prison. What did he do? All right, open the discussion. Was he smart? Wasn't he smart? Did he accept money? Didn't he accept money? But all of us know that even if he's guilty of sin, 26 years is way beyond the price that any other spy has paid for giving information to a friendly nation, to the United States. But what's fabulous about this article, and this article is about David Lukens. Do you recognize the name? David Lukens, Touro College, very close to Rabban Soloveitchik, Talmud of Rabban Soloveitchik. And I have debated many times with David, who is a fabulous individual. But here you see how a person cannot shake the American mentality out of him. And here's an article that appeared August 7th, 1986, in the Jerusalem Post. And the article, he had just given a talk at Eish HaTorah in Yerushalayim, and of course with the arrest of Jonathan Pollard, and by the way, you should do everything you can to try to get Obama to pardon Pollard. The man has suffered enough already. It's mamisha mitzvah pidyon shvuyim in the full sense of the word. But At the time, of course, what was the big issue that was raised? Dual loyalty. This is Napoleon. Remember what Napoleon said to the Jews in 1811 and 1812, 1809, and that whole era of the Sanhedrin, of the Council of Jewish Notables. Napoleon essentially said to the Jews, are you Frenchmen of the Jewish faith, or are you Jews who happen to live in France? And the arrest of Pollard made many Jews uncomfortable, including many Torah Jews, Orthodox Jews, for one simple reason. You're a Jew, and you're living in America, and you're sinning against America. You're robbing, you're giving secret details to another country. Is your loyalty to America, or is your loyalty to Israel as a Jew? And David Lukin speaks about it at Reish HaTorah, and at the end, he talks about himself, and very important to understand him. And they ask him about Aliyah. I have no intention of ever making Aliyah, at least not until the last eagle leaves America, he said. I took him on that sentence. David Lukin is a fascinating contradiction. He effortlessly mixes Talmudic and Midrashim and insider Washington stories in his talk and moves at ease in yeshiva study halls and in Congress. He sees no conflict in a full commitment to America and liberal democracy and Israel and Torah from Sinai. He has no problem wearing his black kippah on the Senate or davening on the floor of the Democratic Convention. And yet there was no doubt who David Lukin's is when he said, quote, as an American, my first loyalty is to my conscience. As a Jew, my first loyalty is to the Torah. But the Torah is my conscience, and it tells me my first loyalty is to the country of the diaspora in which I am living. I am extremely lucky to be living in a country where I can follow my conscience. And this David Lukin's, this statement, fabulous. And a lot of good Jews have this mentality. You can't come and hit them over the head, Aliyah. You have to set an example, and perhaps some of the Divrei Torah I've spoken about over these last 6-7 months have to be quoted in dignity. Perhaps we can have an influence. But Lukin's and his thinking, and this is a good Jew, an observant Jew, this is a Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, this is someone who cares, but you heard what he said. He will not come in Aliyah until the last eagle leaves America. Okay. Let me go further. We recognize Aliyah. We recognize the difficulties. We recognize Lech Lecha, Meyatzecha, Moladetcha, Mibeit Avicha, why it's in that order. We recognize building a name in history or being just another forgotten social security number. Don't forget Ezra and Nehemiah. We recognize that it's not too wise to go back and yell and scream and shout in the middle of Lawrence, in the middle of Far Rockaway, in the middle of Teaneck. People have a life, and they're at home in that life. And only the few who are privileged are big enough to pierce it and do what is ultimately historic. But you've come in Aliyah. You're part of the chosen few. Let me extend some advice to you. I had many students who came in Aliyah, Baruch Hashem. Many students, I've lo aleinu buried students and children of students who I inspired to come in Aliyah and fell in Muhammad Yisrael or fell in terrorist attacks. So among my students, there was one trend I noticed that I could never be part of. And what am I referring to? I had students who would call me, ask me a shaila, keep in touch with me, and would insist on speaking Hebrew to me. I would see them with their wives, insist on speaking Hebrew to their wives. When they first met the young lady, she was a Machon Gold girl. She was in the Michalav Foreign Students Program. She was in Midrashit Moriah. They spoke and fell in love in English, but years later, only Hebrew. And I always felt that this was not necessary. I felt it was an open Gemara and a very important Gemara, which has tremendous implications for Aliyah. The Gemara in Megillah, Daf Chav Tet Amid Aleph, it's in Megillah, it's in many Midrashim. Atidin Batei Kenisiyot or Batei Midrashot Shebubavel Sheyikbu'u Be'eretz Yisrael. That many of the Batei Midrashim and the Batei Knesiyot of Bavel will come in Aliyah and will be placed in Eretz Yisrael. And here you have to ask a simple question. What does the Gemara mean? You're going to take a building, take it apart, number each brick, ship it over to Israel and rebuild it here? I would venture a guess that it would be infinitely cheaper to build a beautiful building from scratch and not to bring over a massive structure from Amsterdam Avenue in Washington Heights. Did you ever study there, Daniel? Okay, Daniel, you know what I'm talking about. Moshe, beautiful building, a Moorish temple. But what it would, what does the Gemara mean? You're going to bring over the Batei Gemara? I think the Gemara is much deeper. In each Gola, we established a lifestyle. Some of it was very pedestrian, perhaps not important. But some of our lifestyle was tremendous success. And the success of the Gola, you have to bring to the State of Israel. When we have the Kibbutz Goliath, when we're building the third Bayit, when we're building the third Commonwealth, where we have 120 different languages here and 120 different mentalities, what was good in the Gola has to be translated to the Israeli scene. And this is very important. Aliyah is a gradual process. I speak English to my wife, that's my natural language. My Hebrew, I'm as much at home in speaking Hebrew as I am in English. But it's not normal for me, it wouldn't be natural for me to speak English to my wife, to my children. True, before we went in Aliyah, I spoke Hebrew to my children. When we got here, I spoke English. But obviously, English was the more natural lingo between us. It's a gradual process. My great-grandchildren, believe me, will be 1,000 times more at home in Hebrew than in English. Among my grandchildren, I have some that are totally at home in English, some who know English, but it's a gradual process. It doesn't have to happen overnight. The same thing, we have so much to contribute here. And what I alluded to before, everyone acknowledges today. In America, we had total assimilation. There was no hope, there was no future. In 1886, a few nudniks, as Nettie Gross put it, on the east side of New York, organized a day school called Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. Added that Yeshivat Eitz Chaim, today, so many years later, we are sitting in a branch of Eitz Chaim in Yerushalayim. Eitz Chaim ultimately becomes Yeshiva University. Read Rabbi Gil Klapperman's doctorate on Yeshiva University going to 1915, and read Aaron Rothkopf's work on Bernard Revel, which covers 15 to 40. Unfortunately, no one has gone beyond it. And I challenge one of you to pick up the cudgels, pick up the challenge, and do a doctorate on Reb Shmuel Belkin. Do it quickly. I should be alive and well, and I can guide you, I can help you. There are problems there, I'm aware of it, but it is a crying shame for the yeshiva that nothing has been done of stature on Reb Shmuel Belkin. Took time. We developed mechanchim. We developed Rabbeim. Who would ever believe that in the United States of America you would have Rabbeim who spoke English and knew baseball? And were living Sefer Torahs. We developed the sense of Hina. We developed the sense of outreach. The whole Baal Tshuva movement began with Anglo mentality. Who could believe what you have today? South Africa. Tens of thousands of Shomer Shabbos Jews in South Africa. Tens and tens and tens of thousands. 90% of Baal Tshuva. If I'm overstating it, 85%. I'm underestimating. I told you, the Chevra Kadisha, the head of the Chevra Kadisha, who's FFB, told me that he has a rule. He won't accept anyone into the Chevra Kadisha in Johannesburg who hasn't been trimmed for 10 years. Could you imagine? Everyone is a Baal Tshuva. He's not. 10 years he has to be a Shomer Shabbos. Then he can come into the Chevra Kadisha. What we created, they need us in Israel. We've made quite a contribution in Israel. We have nothing to be ashamed about. Atid bati knesiyot, Baruch Hashem. You take the Svadik world, their family structure, it's very powerful. Their attitude toward Tarat Mishpacha, it's the, Israel's the only country in the world where more women go to mikveh than are totally Shomeret Shabbat. Just think about what I just said. The only, it's inconceivable elsewhere. But the Sephardic world has a certain mentality that we desperately need. And we Westerners who have been so ruined by Western society, by Hollywood, by the New York Times, there is so much beauty that we need, so much inborn, decent, Yirat Shemayim, and Ahavat HaChayim. You go to the airport, and you see a Sefer Torah is coming out of Israel. They bought a Torah, it's going to Lawrence or Sulphur, if they pay $40,000. And you see the Torah is being carried to the plane. It's being carried through the airport. They're going to take it in their hands, take it up into the plane, and you'll see Sephardic masses jumping forward to kiss the Sefer Torah. Ashkenazim, they're religious, they kiss, they're not religious, couldn't care less. You see Svadim, they're covering their heads. They're pulling out a handkerchief. They're covering their heads. Kissing the Torah. So much. The Russian Aliyah. Who could ever dream that the refusnikim against all odds stood up to the Russian Empire and brought it to its feet? Heroes. Giants. There's so much, so much that we can learn from them. We don't have to become Israelis overnight. We don't have to become pure Israelis at all. When the Russians complained that in Russia we were Jews and here in Israel we're Russians, I said, what's the complaint? I'm proud to say that I am an Israeli of American origins. It's a lot in that statement. I have a lot to be proud of. I don't know. People eulogized me when I was leaving or afterwards, like what I gave up. I don't know how much I gave up. But certainly certain lifestyles, certain values, certain understandings, certain dignity, I brought it with me and I believe it should be here and it should be inculcated here and it should be taught here and it should be an example here and I have nothing to be ashamed of. And Ein Hachinami, in America, I was a Jew, here I am. An American. I'm not ashamed of that. I told you in the army, I write about it in Washington. When I got up to speak the first time, I saw they're laughing at me. They hear the American accent. I don't make a mistake twice. I try not to. We all make mistakes, but if you repeat it, you're an idiot. The second lecture I gave in the army, the second of thousands that were to follow, I got up and said, כפי שאתם מבחינים מהמבטא שלי, לא נולדתי כאן, לא גדלתי כאן, לא הונחתי כאן, ולפי זה יש לי המון ללמד אתכם. Oh boy, they jump forward. Oh, this American has something to teach us. They didn't want to miss a word. And then I gave them Torah, I gave them what I wanted. All right, they got or didn't get, I don't know, but at least they listened in dignity. And yes, it's a struggle, it's a challenge. But there's a great reward. And there's a reward that no one in the Gola can ever feel. And we who live here, we who are integrated, this is a daily parcel of Olam Haba that we have with us. And here I come to Divrei Torah. I write this up in Washington in a different context. Here I come to Divrei Torah I heard from my Rebbe in the mid-50s. Remember the Rav asked the question, I've spoken about this many times, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, were they Jews or weren't they Jews? So of course the gut reaction is they were Jews, there was the Brit Bein HaBetarim, there was a covenant with them. Well, if there was a covenant with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, why did you need another covenant with Moshe Rabbeinu? We know with Matan Torah, you know, Parshat Mishpatim, what happens afterwards. The blood, the sprinkling. Once again, another covenant. Well, as the Rebbe would say in Yiddish, Untvida'ah, one or the other. Either you don't need the second covenant because Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were Jews, or you needed the second covenant because there were no Jews before Matan Torah and Moshe Rabbeinu. And this is a very powerful question. The Mishnah LeMelech of Avraham Razanz in his Drush Sefer, Parashat HaDrachim, asked this very question and spends 22 rabbinic folios answering it. But the heart of the answer is very powerful. There are two levels to being a Jew. On the first level, religion is purely a personal matter. Kadosh Baruch Hu made a covenant with Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. They had to be Jews. There was no concept of peoplehood. Religion was limited to the individual person. It was much like the Western concept. You see once again Falklanders acting up. Great Britain and Argentina can go to war again. They went to war in the 1990s. Who killed who? Christian killed Christian. France and Germany went to war how many times over Alsace-Lorraine? You don't have enough fingers on your hands. Who killed who? Christian killed Christian. Religion's a personal matter. You want to be president of the United States, you're an American. You're a Quaker, you're a Catholic, you're a Protestant, you're a Jew. So what? Religion's a personal matter. That's the first level of the covenant. The second level brings us to the uniqueness and the totality of Torah experience. It's a covenant not with individuals, but with peoplehood, with a nation, with your fellow Jews. Am Yisrael. Torah and Eretz Yisrael are not given to individuals, they're given to the totality of the Jewish people. This is why we needed Matan Torah, we needed once again a second covenant, we needed Hatafat Dam Brit, all that comes with becoming a nation, a people. We had to show we're unified. This is why the Korban Pesach is the sine qua non requirement before Matan Torah, before leaving Egypt, before going to Eretz Yisrael. Because what did the Korban Pesach accomplish? You ate it al hasova at the end of the meal. Each person only had a kazayat. A lamb is a big animal. Hundreds of people shared one lamb. That is symbolic of our sharing one destiny. Jewish peoplehood, a Jewish nation. The world can never understand this. They can never forgive us for this. Because this makes us different. When read the Rav, read what Rakefet writes, quoting his Rebbe word by word, where the Rav writes, the interconnection of every Jew in the world, a Jew speaking a different language all the way over in some part of communist Russia is suffering, then a Jew enjoying all the freedom of Boston feels his suffering. We're not like the French and the Germans or the British and the Argentines who can shoot at one another and kill one another and not have any pangs of conscience. And this is why the Mayanah Shel Torah, which is a wonderful drish sefer on Parshat HaShavua, basing himself on the concept I just developed, explains why we call Shabbos HaGadol, Shabbos HaGadol. Everyone questions, why Shabbos HaGadol? Why do we call it Shabbos HaGadol? What does it mean, Shabbos HaGadol? So the cynics say, of course, because the rabbis speak on that Shabbos, and they speak endlessly, and it seems like a long, long Shabbos, because the rabbis are boring us, that's why it's Shabbos HaGadol. All right, if you want a nice interpretation to joke around with, that sounds good. He gives the interpretation that why is it Shabbos HaGadol? Because it's like a bar mitzvah boy. Until a kid is bar mitzvah, until a kid turns 13, he does mitzvah. But he does mitzvah the Torah chinuch. You're chayav lechanech at the youngster. Your father took you to shul when you were a kid, right or wrong? Your father sort of with that you had tefillin, that you ate kosher, but until you're 13 or until you're 12 for a lady, it's betorat chinuch. When you have your bar mitzvah, you become a total Jew. It's now betorat mitzvah v'oseh. It's very different than chinuch. I always write, if I get a letter inviting me to a bar mitzvah, I write divrei brecha, samachti lehitpaseh, ki od ma'at tagia lematzav shel mitzvah v'oseh. Shabbos HaGadol, the Jew became bar mitzvah. Until Shabbos HaGadol, until he took out the lamb and got prepared for peoplehood and nationhood and common destiny, he was only a Jew with the concept of individuality. Now on Shabbos HaGadol, he becomes a people, a nation. It's a new level. It's Shabbos HaGadol, like a bar mitzvah boy coming to a new stage of chiyuv of mitzvah. That feeling you only have in Israel. And that's why, if you're familiar with Tosfot, the Sugi in Sanhedrin, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LeZeh, where does the Arevut begin? It begins when they enter Yisrael. It's peoplehood, Eretz Yisrael. It's our Nachla. We all have Dalet Amot. We're all interwoven. We're all partners. It's a cooperative. Yisrael Arevim Zeh LeZeh, it can only be forged with the second level of commitment, the second level of Brit. It's a very rewarding feeling, but there's something else about Eretz Yisrael. And here I have to tell you, I actually brought a very distinguished family, an Aliyah, with the little Divrei Torah you're about to hear. It was the early 90s in the Sukkah of the OU, when it was yet on Rehov Strauss, if you remember. And these were people visiting their children. Their children had been my students. These are prominent people, president of the Young Israel of Hillcrest, one of the founders, etc. Totally at home in America. Totally at home in Beit Avicha, totally at home in Moladetcha, totally at home in Atzecha. And I spoke in the Sukkah. And they told me, this brought them an Aliyah. I owe it to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Likutei Sichot on Chag HaSukkot, the Rebbe asked a wonderful question. Why do you call it Chag HaSukkot? Why not Chag HaLulav? Lulav is a beautiful mitzvah, Dalet Minim. Sukkot is a beautiful mitzvah. But why Chag HaSukkot? Why does it win out? If you're not going to call it Chag HaKatzir, so at least call it Chag HaSukkot, fine. Chag HaLulav. Bring in the Dalet Minim. And the Rebbe said so beautifully that the overwhelming majority of mitzvot we do with our limbs. You put on tefillin, you put on tefillin. You take a lulav and etrog, you take a lulav and etrog, you blow a shofar. All right, your mouth is involved, your hands are involved, your ears are involved. Sukkot is very, very unique because the mitzvah envelops you. It surrounds you. It's total immersion. It's like being in a mikveh. If a woman goes to mikveh and the water doesn't totally surround her, the tefillah is not kashera. And this is why Chag HaSukkot went out, because it has that added feature that Lulav and Etrog do not have. A sukkah, it envelops the being of the Jew. Well, now you just think, mikveh is like that, sukkah is like that. But they're limited. Sukkah, if we go out to a sukkah now, do we have a mitzvah? Moshe Laster will lock me up and throw the key away. The last of the morons. He thinks, on what is this? We're almost Rosh Chodesh Shvat. He thinks in the end of Teves he can sit in a sukkah? Wow. Mikveh, all right, today we can go to mikveh. Maybe tomorrow for men it's meaningless. But all right, a woman goes to mikveh once a month. But that's it. There's one mikveh, one mitzvah that completely envelops us. And we're Mekayemet 724. Mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. What a mitzvah. What a feeling. What beauty. What dignity. What history. What a past. What a future. My wife and I celebrated our 50th anniversary. I'll tell you a secret. We walked Dalet Amot in Eretz Yisrael, where we never walked before. We went to Pisgat Zev. At the time, my grandson was getting married and thinking of buying in Pisgat Zev. We wanted to see Givat Zev, excuse me. Pisgat Zev, I have a daughter living there. Givat Zev. Went to Givat Zev, and we asked where are they building, where they intend to build, and people showed us, and we got there, we walked Dalet Amot. And today, my grandchildren live in the very spot where we walked Dalet Amot, the Eretz Yisrael. What a mitzvah. Can you put a price on it? With all due respect to the New York Yankees, and with all due respect to the frustrations at times of Israeli drivers, I take mitzvah Eretz Yisrael. And this is the ultimate recognition that a Jew has to have. There's no place like home, and home for the Jew is Eretz Yisrael. And there's Yerushalmi and Sota, Perek Shmini, Halacha Dalet, right towards the end. So it talks about those who go back from war. And you all know that Misha Banabayat Valochan Cho, you know what I tell jokes about this. If you haven't heard the joke, you'll tell me in a few minutes, I'll tell it to you. But Misha Banabayat Valochan Cho, he leaves, don't want him to be killed and not enjoy the fruits of his labors. And the Gemara questions, Yochel Habonabayat Bechutz Laretz Yehei Chozea. What about a guy who's in the army and says, wait a minute, I'm building a complex in Beverly Hills, building a complex, I don't know, in Chicago, in Skokie. I don't want to go to war. Talmud Lomar, Velo Chancho, Et Shemitzvah Lahancho, Yatsa Zeh, She'eno Mitzvah Lahancho. And the Pnei Moshe, and the Korban Ha'edah both did the same explanation, that Eretz Yisrael mishum yishuv shehadira Eretz Yisrael mitzvah yishuv haaretz. This is where it's at. You're building a home, it's in Eretz Yisrael. You're outside of Eretz Yisrael, that doesn't count. That's not a home. That's not permanent. That is not for a Jew who is imbued with Torah. And what a powerful, powerful Yerushalmi. And we pass him that way. Powerful Gemara in Ketuvot. Powerful Gemara. Ketuvot, Perek Yudbet, right at the end of Halacha Gimel. And boy, this Gemara is as real today as it was when it was written onto 2,000 years ago. Well, you see, all these people live a very fine, beautiful life, far from Eretz Yisrael. I just got a call last week. Rebbe, this person died, this rabbi died. Sending the body for burial in Eretz Yisrael. When do we start sitting shiva? We're accompanying the hearse to the airport, and then of course they'll take the Aron and it goes into El Al and they put it on the plane and they're going to turn around and go back home. When do we start sitting shiva? All right, you've gotten that call many times. I've gotten that call many times. What are you passing? It's very simple that you turn around, you take off your shoes. From that moment on, you start sitting shiva because you're not accompanying the body, you're no longer an onein, and avedit begins for you immediately. It's the way we pass. But as I spoke about yesterday, the crystallization and the hitkapshut is the halacha be avedit kedivrei hamekil, and that's the way we paskin the halacha. Listen to this Gemara. And David Pardo better listen with three ears. The Gemara tells,
All four.
Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. And the Gemara tells the following story, that two of the Amoraim were walking at the borders of Eretz Yisrael. And as they're walking, they look up and they see coffins being brought mechutz laretz l'Eretz Yisrael. Exactly what I'm telling you about. They see El Al flying in, and Lelis Aronot, six bodies around the plane. One said to another, "What good are these people?" I refer to the pasuk of Yirmiyahu, "Nachlati samtem toeva b'chayeim." That in your lifetime you couldn't live in Israel, you stayed far away from Israel, and now in your death you come and you defile the land? Wow. And yet nevertheless, Eretz Yisrael is Eretz Yisrael. Amalei, Kivin Shemagin L'Eretz Yisrael, when the coffins reached the borders of Eretz Yisrael, Hayunot Lin Gushafa, they would take a bunch of dirt from the Holy Land, Umeinichel Alaronan, and they would put it on the coffin, Dichtiv V'chipea Admato Amo, that the very land of Israel has so much holiness, so much beauty, so much depth, so much spirituality that it achieves atonement for anyone who has that dirt in his coffin. So you see, it's a dual feeling, a double-edged sword, a dialectical tension. It's a thesis and an antithesis, to quote Hegel, or to quote the Rav. We have to be indulgent and forgiving. Aliyah is not easy. It's changing a lifestyle, changing a personality. It's changing a frame of reference. It's changing all that we were accustomed to, all that we knew, all that was part and parcel of us from early childhood on. Not everyone can do it. We can't be angry at those who don't. I always say, if you can't make it, we need your children. We need your grandchildren here. On the other hand, those that come, what they have achieved, what they have gained, how they have transformed themselves, their personalities, their personage, their gestalt, their thinking, their spirituality, their whole demeanor, what they have achieved, indescribable. And we live at a time where there's going to be, at least for the immediate future, this dual interaction. Am I angry at the coffins that are coming in? Yes. Why didn't you come during your lifetimes? Am I really angry? No, I have to be Malamed Skut. They found it difficult. They loved the land. They supported the land. They gave money to the land. I just turned on the news this morning. The only Israeli news. All the news is about the Arabs and about Obama and about Gingrich and about Syria and about Iran and about the Straits being closed, not being closed. One bit of Israeli news. More money was raised at a bonds function in America last night than was ever raised before at any single bonds function. So Baruch Hashem, they give to the land. We have a right to put dirt on their coffin and let them enjoy the merit of at least being buried in the land. What, of course, always comforts me is that inevitably, people being buried here, the children visit, the grandchildren visit. Many of them have grandchildren living here. And whenever they visit, it aids the economy, so one has to approach it with the dual concept or the dual feeling or the dialectical feeling that I try to develop in this lecture. So let me reiterate, what did we do today? We did Baruch Hashem. It's a lot to speak about. Number one, we spoke about the Levim who didn't come, stayed behind. We spoke about Miriam Beinhorn Levinger, the choice, it's your life. Another social security number or a name inscribed in Ezra v'Nehemia. Powerful thought. We have to be realistic. I quoted to you about J. David Shulman and his going back and the dialectical tension. There's no other way to describe it. I hope maybe with everyone listening, I can find out what happened to J. David Shulman. You can't be angry at the Jews. Nettie Gross overstates the case in Haranga. I think that David Lukens gives us good insight into someone who is an American and proud to be American and loves Israel, but he will never leave America until the last eagles have departed. I'm curious where his children are today. But if you're big enough and you've made the move, then, of course, I spoke about the Gemara and Megillah, even but they can see it. It doesn't remain. Doesn't mean you become an Israeli overnight. There's a lot that we can contribute. And when you've made the move, of course, how it spiritually affects you, Shabbos HaGadol, Am Yisrael, Kritot HaBrit, one Brit, the second Brit, individual, collective community, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Meir D'Kvor, and why it's Chag HaSukkot, and the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael, the only mitzvah I know of that envelops you and surrounds you 24/7. Wow! And then the Gemara in Yerushalmi and Sota, abide in Chutz Laretz, does not count, it's not permanent, and the burial, pro and con, and of course, Yaakov Avinu, Lemi Yendorf, Yaakov Avinu, when he's leaving Eretz Yisrael, it says with the Chalom, he asked for two things. Remember? Can anyone help me? What's the pasuk? No? V'natateri lechem lechol u'beged lilbosh. Well, if you study anthropology, the basis of existence is, of course, food, clothing, and shelter. And he doesn't ask for shelter. And the answer is very simple, because he was going into Chutz Laretz, and he knew the Gemara and Sota that was quoted. permanent shelter can only be in Eretz Yisrael. Food and clothing we can get in the Golos, but permanent shelter is only in Eretz Yisrael. Now, let me just mention, those of you that can listen to yesterday's shiur on the website, because it was a very, very important shiur, and we're going to come back to that shiur months from now, Halacha L'maisa, but dealing with the Shulchan Aruch and dealing with the Rambam, very important shiur. I'm now moving in Sunday into Shelet and Shavat, and who will see him? Yosef Chaim, our Baghdadi friend, tell him that I'm going to Rav Ovadia Yosef, very deep, very strong, very sharp. So he should try to beat the hell out of his chavruta and drag him to hear some Divrei Torah that might change his life. Next Monday is very different. It's the Shloshim for my mother. I will still have a beard in the morning. If you'll be kind enough to tell me I look like a slob, and don't tell me how good I look, please, because I look into the mirror, I'm ready to faint. Quoting Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, I'll appreciate it. If not, I paid someone off to tell me, and she already is not my student, so she has to listen to me. So the Amit women wanted me to give, my mother was very active in Amit, they wanted me to give the shiur there, but I want to do it here, I don't want to be I'm going to give, based upon the hesped I gave, I want to elaborate and go into it a lot deeper. So next Monday morning at 9 o'clock is a Shloshim hesped, based upon the funeral hesped for my mother. And by that I invited women, I don't know how many can come, but I'll know by Thursday, have some idea, and we'll arrange the seating in the classroom so we can hold everyone here. Mark wanted me to go into the auditorium, but I don't want to because the heating there is not like here. If it'll be cold like today, it's a pleasure to sit here. So I want it to be warm, I want it to be nice. So Be'ezrat Hashem, that is the schedule. Then the week afterwards in the Monday class, I have a little bit more to say about Israel and religious Zionism. And then it is 999,000 dollars, a bargain that it's not in the millions. We begin Das Torah. Many, many weeks of lectures. You will not be the same again after you hear those lectures. You will be a real gadol, a real ben Torah. Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, now, this, again, anyone interested, this is Divrei Torah from Benji Hechter, Wayu Mismach in Toronto. Very innovative on Parshat HaShavua, very much up to date. If anyone has a bit of a Hasidic neshama, this shows the Satmar Rebbe, who is my Satmar Rebbe, with my name, Reb Arela, in Palm Springs, davening with Lubavitch, taking part in a Lubavitch affair, and it shows the Rebbe, the Shluchim there with the Satmar Rebbe, B'Shalom uv'Shalva. I am very impressed. Excuse me? To run away from the winter, like I can, believe me, I wish I'd be in Palm Springs today and yesterday. If anyone is interested, this is from the memorial volume from Dr. Belkin. It's Rabbi Belkin's life. And this is a Xerox from the memorial volume on the history of the Teachers Institute and its connection with Yeshiva University. I have here a video, but I guess no one here is interested. It seems only Rabbi Rubin is the one who can play videos. It's the original Odd Couple. If you're aware of how the Odd Couple began, it was a movie with Walter Matthau. Later they turned it in and Klugman took over. Jack Klugman, all Jews, right down the line. The other guy's also a Jew, Felix. And Felix had Jewish identity, unlike Klugman, who came from a grim home from Philadelphia, and he's still alive, you should know, but that's the way the ball bounces. Maybe they gave money to Israel, so I shouldn't be so angry. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vaganya.
Thank you.